Well, good morning. This is going to be our first lesson in a survey of the book of Judges, codenamed SOJ. I didn't have enough room to write other things on there. I've been studying Judges for a few months now, which all started with the reading of Richard Rogers' sermons on Judges, which I have found to be real helpful, and also reading Kiddo's devotions, I guess you could say, on the book of Judges, and they took me to task a bit, I must admit, on what's happening in the book of Judges and what takes place. Because of that, I thought, well, this might make a good study if we explore what happened during this time period. And I think, as is often the case, I plan on being as provocative as I possibly can to encourage you and direct you to look at the book of Judges in new light and a helpful light to see what was happening in the people of Israel during these days. So normally I would start off in a class like this with an introduction to the time and the place and the people and who was doing what and what part of the world and what was happening, but I'm going to skip that for this particular study and integrate that as we proceed through each week. So I have a few opening comments, but before we get to those, I am desirous to have a short sentence summary from a number of you. If you could characterize the book of Judges in your own words, how would you characterize the book of Judges? Doesn't have to be a long, detailed explanation. Sarah.
Like, the Israelites sin, they get a judge, they reform, the judge dies, they sin again and get another.
Okay. They sin, they get a judge, they're delivered, they sin, the judge dies, and they sin again. Okay, that's one. Liz.
Everybody was doing what was right in their own eyes.
Everyone was doing what was right in his own eyes. Okay, that's another perception we have of the book of Judges. What else is out there?
We might say a forgetful nation.
A forgetful nation. A forgetful nation.
All that God did for them.
That's right.
In the wilderness and
so forth. A forgetful people. Now, those are good characterizations. Anything else? Surely there's something else.
God's faithfulness.
God's faithfulness in spite of man's unfaithfulness. That's true as well. That's right. Anybody else? You know I don't give a lot of opportunities to offer comments, so I'm trying to be generous and mend my ways up front. But I'm prepared to rescind the offer on a moment's notice. Okay. Well, let's proceed with those comments. I think there's a lot of truth, but I think there's a lot of half-truth in what you said. And I hope over the course of the next few weeks here that we'll be able to explore some of those things. It's my intention to take the book, not in painstaking detail. We're going to take the first two chapters up through the first opening of chapter 3 with some detail, and then we're going to skid through a number of the judges, and then we'll also have a little more detail with the end of the book. I'll save some comments about that for just a little bit. So the first question we might want to ask is, who wrote the book? Well, it's anyone's guess. We'll have more on that later. Secondly, when was it written? Well, hard to say. We'll have more on that later. Thirdly, what kind of style does it employ? Okay, it's gritty. It's brutal. It's offensive to nearly every Victorian sensibility. It's full of rough and tumble, and yet it shines with redemption. And I'll warn you, if you're given over to Victorian sensibilities, you might stumble a few times going through this class. It's tough stuff going through Judges. What are the major themes given? Well, we've heard a few of the comments earlier, but we see repentance and restoration. We see faith. We see judgment. We see the sovereignty of God. We see mercy and half-heartedness. We also see syncretistic worship. We see a jealousy of God's glory, and we see the failure of the priesthood in the book of Judges. So who were these characters, judges? How does it get its name? Well, the word that's used here is shofetim, as best I can tell. But the problem is the way the Hebrews had described these judges does not really correspond to our Western or American sense of a judge. Here the word is used to describe someone who is making... maybe state it the other way. In our country and in most of the Western world, a judge is someone who acts impartially to hear cases brought before the state, for instance. So we might have the state on one side and the citizenry on the other, and the judge is here to arbitrate to make sure that justice is meted out fairly and blindly, and that they can execute the laws of the state there. And he might also be employed to hear a case between parties and to arbitrate, and that he would be someone who would be outside of the law enforcement mechanisms and yet not part of the legislative process. That's how we would understand the concepts of judges. But that's not how the word is used or even described in this book. A judge in this book is a leader of the people, used most often, but not exclusively, and not all military leaders were called this, but to be used in a sense of someone who was in leading the country in a, to a certain sense, a judicial function, but more of a military leading the people to war. They also had not necessarily a priestly function, but they were there to govern the people according to God's law. Not there sitting in a position to arbitrate matters, but oftentimes were used to administer God's law. There is an element that the judges were there to listen to cases brought before people. If you'll turn to chapter 4, and we'll take a look at one such strange judge. And this is referring to Deborah. It says, and this is a little interesting how they word this, but in verse 4, Deborah, a prophetess, the wife of Lapidoth, was judging Israel at that time, and she would sit under the palm tree of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel, and the mountains of Ephraim, and the children of Israel came up to her for judgment. So here's someone who was working or occupied in that capacity of hearing cases brought before people. And she is considered a prophetess of Israel, but we also see her functioning in the capacity of a judge as well. So that's those are my introductory remarks as to how we are going to approach this particular book. But to give you some kind of lay of the land, the book is not written, contrary to how it might seem as you're reading it, the book is not written in chronological order. And that gives quite a bit of stumbling, I think, for people trying to make sense of all of this. So you have these opening chapters, then you get into these various judges, and then you've got the end of the book where you have the Danite controversy, you have war with Benjamin, the attacks on Benjamin, and you see those phrases repeated at the end of the book, every man did what was right in his own eyes. The trouble is, that's not characteristic necessarily of the whole book. Those incidents are compiled at the end, but they actually, it looks like they took place much earlier in the life of Israel toward the beginning rather than the end. So my approach to this is going to be a little bit different, and I'm going to chop the book up just a bit, because I think it's helpful to see the book of Judges in its chronological fashion. What was happening and how did we get there? And if you don't see it that way, the transition between Joshua and when you get over to 1 Samuel can be a little bumpy at times. It is not the writer's intention, the author of Judges, to give a strict historical account of how things transpired. We'll have a little bit more on that in just a few minutes. But in terms of the division of the book and how I'm going to approach it, we're going to take the what is commonly called the introduction of the book, which comprises the first two chapters and the opening of chapter 3. 1 through 3:6. And that could even be divided into two sections. You could broad categories claim that we're going to look at the view of Israel to Canaan and Israel to Jehovah. I'm going to press these boundaries very hard, but it's, I think, helpful to divide it up some way where we can take a look at the various elements. And then we'll move through the history of the judges, which takes the takes us through 3:7 all the way to chapter 16, where you get the history of the judges proper and the men who were raised up and the men who delivered Israel. And then we're going to look at 17 and 21 as well. That we'll see that in the two categories when I mentioned the Danite idolatries and the war against Benjamin. But I may take this section following our introduction over the next couple weeks. So if I show up and say we're now going to go to the end of Judges, you'll understand why. I do think there's some helpful hints there. All right, we're going to look at, with some detail, what transpires in this first chapter this week. That's our whole goal, is to get through this particular week with chapter 1. So, open your Bibles to chapter 1, and I'd like to read the chapter. Now, after the death of Joshua, it came to pass that the children of Israel asked the Lord, saying, "Who shall be first to go up for us against the Canaanites to fight against them?" And the Lord said, "Judah shall go up. Indeed, I have delivered the land into his hand." So Judah came to Simeon, his brother, "Come up with me to my allotted territory, that we may fight against the Canaanites, and I will likewise go with you to your allotted territory." And Simeon went with them. Then Judah went up, and the Lord delivered the Canaanites and the Perizzites into their hand, and they killed 10,000 men of Bezek. And they found Adonai Bezek in Bezek, and fought against him. And they defended the Canaanites and the Perizzites. Then Adonai Bezek fled, and they pursued him, and caught him, and cut off his thumbs and his big toes. And Adonai Bezek said, 70 kings with their thumbs and big toes cut off, used to gather scraps under my table, as I have done, so God has repaid me." Then they brought him to Jerusalem, and there he died. Now the children of Judah fought against Jerusalem and took it. They struck it with the edge of the sword and set the city on fire. And afterward the children of Judah went down to fight against the Canaanites who dwelt in the mountains, in the south and in the lowland. Then Judah went against the Canaanites who dwelt in Hebron. Now the name of Hebron was formerly Kirjath Arba, and they killed Shishai, Ahiman, and Talmai. From there they went against the inhabitants of Debir. The name of Debir was formerly Kirjath Zephar. Then Caleb said, "Whoever attacks Kirjath Sefer and takes it, to him I will give my daughter Aksah as a wife." And Othniel, the son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother, took it. So he gave him his daughter Aksah as his wife. Now it happened, when she came to him, that she urged him to ask her father for a field. And she dismounted from her donkey, and Caleb said to her, "What do you wish?" So she said to him, "Give me a blessing. Since you have given me land in the south, give me also springs of water." And Caleb gave her the upper springs and the lower springs. Now the children of the Kenite, Moses' father-in-law, went up from the city of palms of the children of Judah into the wilderness of Judah, which lies in the south near Arad. And they went and dwelt among the people. And Judah went with his brother Simeon, and they attacked the Canaanites, who inhabited Zephthah, and utterly destroyed it. So the name of the city was called Hormah. Also Judah took Gaza with its territory, Ascalon with its territory, Ekron with its territory. So the Lord was with Judah, and they drove out the mountaineers, but they could not drive out the inhabitants of the lowland, because they had chariots of iron. And he gave Hebron to Caleb, as Moses had said. Then he expelled from there the three sons of Anak. But the children of Benjamin did not drive out the Jebusites who inhabited Jerusalem. So the Jebusites dwell with the children of Benjamin in Jerusalem to this day. And the house of Joseph also went up against Bethel, and the Lord was with them. So the house of Joseph sent men to spy out Bethel. The name of the city was formerly Luz. And when the spies saw a man coming out of the city, they said to him, "Please show us the entrance to the city, and we will show you mercy." So he showed them the entrance of the city, and they struck the city with the edge of the sword. But they let the man and all his family go. And the man went to the land of the Hittites, built the city, and called its name Luz, which is its name to this day. However, Manasseh did not drive out the inhabitants of Beth Shean and its villages, or Taanach and its villages, or the inhabitants of Dor and its villages, or the inhabitants of Ibleam and its villages, or the inhabitants of Megiddo and its villages, for the Canaanites were determined to dwell in that land. And it came to pass, when Israel was strong, that they put the Canaanites under tribute, but did not completely drive them out. Nor did Ephraim drive out the Canaanites who dwelt in Gezer, so the Canaanites dwelt in Gezer among them. Nor did Zebulun drive out the inhabitants of Kitron, or the inhabitants of Nahalol, or the Canaanites, so the Canaanites dwell among them, and were put under tribute. Nor did Asher drive out the inhabitants of Aco, or the inhabitants of Sidon, or of Alab, or Akle, Helba, Aphek, or Rehob. So the Asherites dwelled among the Canaanites, the inhabitants of the city, for they did not drive them out. Nor did Naphtali drive out the inhabitants of Beth Shemesh, or the inhabitants of Beth Anath, but they dwelt among the Canaanites, the inhabitants of the land. Nevertheless, the inhabitants of Beth Shemesh and Beth Anath were put under tribute to them. And the Amorites forced the children of Dan into the mountains. They would not allow them to come down to the valley, and the Amorites were determined to dwell in Mount Heres, in Aijalon, and in Shaalabim. Yet when the strength of the house of Joseph became greater, they were put under tribute. Now the boundary of the Amorites was from the ascent of Akrabib and Selah and upward. So you see the account given here, lots of historical names and places, lots of details. And I think just for a minute, I want to go over a little bit of the map of Israel and how it was divided up. It can be helpful as you're going through Judges to get a picture of what's happening and who's doing what. Typically, at least I find it a bit more comfortable to see everything in its place and have all the tribes listed and such and who did what. Well, Judges is just not written that way. It doesn't give all the information that you'd like to have. Now, I dug this map. Bruce and I got it out of the church library. You going back and pulling out treasures of old, I guess. But you can see the outline that's roughly what's taking place, and the various battles are mentioned, and we'll take a look at those in a little more detail through this. But you have Simeon and Judah, Benjamin, you have Ephraim, the west inheritance of Manasseh, and the eastern inhabitants of Manasseh, Gad and Reuben. You have Issachar, Zebulun, Asher and Naphtali up the north. And you don't see much in the way of what's being described in this first chapter taking place on the eastern side of Israel, but over on the western side is where this first chapter takes a look at. We'll point out some of those things as we move through this. But the opening in chapter 1, verse 1, gives us a very helpful piece of information as to when the events of this book transpired. It says, "Now after the death of Joshua, it came to pass." So this book was written, obviously, after Joshua had lived, but we don't know exactly when it was. We know the events took place after Joshua had lived, but we don't know exactly when that is. Now, this first chapter can be a little tricky. Well, when we get to the sections, I'll show you what's going on. But it actually goes back and forth between what happened during the time of Joshua and what happened after the death of Joshua. And it can be helpful to see that. But it's worth noting that simply because the opening, this has been a point of criticism of this book over the years, that because it says now these things came after the death of Joshua, it came to pass, that everything that follows took place after the death of Joshua. Well, that's not true. Chapter 1 doesn't list things that way, and it doesn't point to a contradiction in the scriptures, but it points to the writer has a different function in his mind other than giving a strict year-by-year narrative as to what's going on. But however, the book of Judges takes place after the death of Joshua and after the death of the elders that lived along with him, and it puts things into a frame for an outline that we can look at. So, right from the start, we can see that the children of Israel asked the Lord. They were inquiring of the Lord. Joshua was dead. The elders had moved on, and they have new leadership in place. What do? They ask the Lord, what is it that we're supposed to do? Who shall go up first? Well, the Lord told them that Judah shall go up first. And I think it's well worth mentioning that the people of God were seeking the Lord. asking him his direction as to what's supposed to take place now. What are we supposed to do? They ask God, give us some direction, and he does. He says, send Judah up here. So Judah, for one reason or another, convinced Simeon, his brother, to go with him into war. And in this section, that God explicitly promises that the land has been delivered. That the land has been delivered. That they have the inheritance. It has been delivered. It was now, however, there's a big and vast difference between this land being conquered, which is what happened under Joshua's reign, if you will, under his military rule. There's a big difference between the land being completely conquered and the land being empty. The land was not empty. It was filled with all kinds of people, but this is what they were supposed to do. Now, Judah's job, and so for all the children of Israel, and this is very important to remember, that Judah's job was to execute God's judgment. This is not merely one group of people desirous of a piece of real estate that somebody else had. This is not a matter of the collective tribes of Israel being covetous, and that they simply wanted to go into this land because they liked the land. That's not the case at all. In fact, God had promised this land to Abraham in Genesis 15. He had told them that he was going to give this land to them. He said, but there's one problem. The iniquity of the land is not yet full. I'm not ready for you to take that land. I'm going to forbear with these people. For hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, God allowed the Canaanites to fill this land, as well as other groups, but under the broad umbrella of the Canaanites. And why is that? Because he's a long-suffering God who is patient and gives people time to repent. But he said the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. When the iniquity of the Amorites was full, there was only one course of action that needed to take place, and that the people of God needed to go in there and kill them. That was God's judgment on them, not just the lust of a tribe to get a piece of real estate. It was God's anger that they were fulfilling, his justice that they were fulfilling. If you see the book of Judges and the judges that were described throughout the book as instruments of God's wrath upon the land that God had decided should be executed, it helps in seeing that at the heart of the matter, the children of Israel should have obeyed the Lord. It's not just a matter of wanting a better piece of real estate. But at the heart of the matter, God told them, execute my judgment on these people. The iniquity of the land is full. They wouldn't do it. They wouldn't do it. They thought better of God's plan. So let's look over in verses 5 through 7. We have this account of Adonai Bezek, which his name just simply means the Lord of Bezek and the place that he had. Adonai Bezek was a... There are a couple people in the Bible with names very similar to this, and we'll look at that in just a minute. But Adonai Bezek was a fellow who obviously had a tremendous amount of influence over the area. It does give us a bit of insight into the life of the Canaanites. He had described that there were 70 kings under his table that used to beg for food because he had cut off their thumbs and their big toes so that they couldn't walk or run away, and they couldn't... wield a spear or a sword very effectively, and it was a way to humiliate them. Now, one of the problems in understanding Judges is the compression of time. Adonai Bezek is boasting about what he's done in his confession of the rightness of God's judgment against him. And he says, 70 kings have I had. Well, I don't think you should imagine that he had this big table and there were 70 men crawling around with the dogs trying to get food all simultaneously. I think what he's referring to is that over time, he had conquered 70 of these kings and humiliated them in such a way that he was able to bring them into the subjection that he desired so that they could be humiliated and brought before him. Now, if you look at the map and you see all these various little cities, at this time in the world, the idea of these sovereign nation states had really not emerged in this part of the land. What you'll find is that people were still operating largely with city states, that the king was was ruling over a very small area. So you don't have to go far and wide to find 70 kings. It's not as if he had to conquer this and go all the way up to Turkey or all the way over to India. He wasn't Alexander the Great trying to do these things. These are your garden variety petty tyrants that you could find laying around anywhere on the western side of Canaan. But it was important nonetheless that they were city-states. And you see this reference also with Abraham when Lot was captured. And it was the five kings that went off and Abraham had to go with his militia and attack and conquer these people. And so, yes, Henry?
I was just thinking of something. The fact that it was still city-states and itself was God's providence, because, you know, he didn't want them to chase the whole population out before they had actually grown to be able to fill in those areas of land. And by city-states, you know, you can conquer one area without necessarily totally crashing the government of another area.
That's right. That's correct. So you look at the judgment that was meted out to this fella, and you think, well, why did they do this? Why did they cut off his thumbs and his toes and humiliate him? The text tells us that they brought him to Jerusalem and they killed him. But why did they do this ahead of time? Well, even Adonai Bezek didn't question why. He saw it was God's judgment upon him. If you'll look down here in verse 7, he said, "As I have done, so God has repaid me." He doesn't say that, whoever was in charge of Judah at the time has repaid me and turned this back on me. He said, God's done it. The idea that the judgment of God was coming upon the land was known to the inhabitants of the land to varying degrees. We'll see that later with Gideon. And we see it certainly with Ai and with Rahab. But Matthew Henry makes some very helpful comments on this particular passage. What desolations he, that is Adonai Bezek, had made among his neighbors. He had wholly subdued 70 kings to such a degree as to have them as prisoners. We cannot suppose that Adonai Bezek had 70 of these petty princes at once for his slaves, but first and last in the course of his reign he had thus disposed and abused so many, who perhaps were many of them kings of the same cities that successively opposed him, and whom he thus treated to please his own imperious, barbarous fancy and for a terror to others. It seems the Canaanites had been wasted by civil wars and those bloody ones among themselves, which would very much facilitate the conquest of them by Israel. Judah, in conquering Adonai Bezek, did in effect conquer 70 kings. So you can see that when you take out this big fella, and there must have been some significance to it because they decided not to kill him immediately and drag him all the way up to Jerusalem in tow, so that there was some reason why they had that to in their mind. But you can see that because these people had been fighting, they were bloodthirsty themselves, that in conquering several of these people, they had in fact conquered a good part of the land. All right, now when you get to verse 8, it says, "Now the children of Israel fought against Jerusalem and took it," all the way down, really, until you get to verse 17, and there's several accounts, but within verses 8 to 17, you're going back in time to a period of Joshua's day. You're going back and you're not sitting in the same front seat for whatever reason. You can see these accounts in Joshua 10. We're not going to go back and read these, but there's an extended account with Caleb and his efforts that took place, and the giving of his daughter to Othniel in marriage, and what had transpired, and her asking for the upper and lower springs. We read the accounts, you've got the ideas. But this is going back in time to describe. We'll talk more about Othniel later, but I think the basic idea is to lay the groundwork that this Othniel was a good and godly man that was zealously pursuing God's will. So we're going to skip over verses 8 to 17, and then you get to verse 17, and it says, "And Judah went with his brother Simeon." Remember, that's what happened at the beginning of the book, that Judah and Simeon were together. We had this first set of battles, and then we go back in time and we look and see what happened under Joshua's reign. Now we're coming back with the two boys together, and they attacked the Canaanites who inhabited Zephthah and utterly destroyed it, and the name was Hormah. They took Gaza and Ashkelon with its territory, Ekron and others. All that territory is around here, the Ashkelon, Gaza, Ekron, all these areas became strongholds of the Philistines in later years, and wasn't that much longer. But you'll remember the five kings that fought against David were the five kings of these Philistine territories up and down the sea coast here. The Philistines tended to cover that sea coast area. Alright, so why is it that when you get to verse 17, you've just had this long discourse of going back under Joshua's day as to what had taken place? If the book of Judges was written, say, 400 years or 300 years after these events took place, what would be the point of incorporating stories from an earlier time period when you explicitly make mention that you're starting from a later time period? So we start with the death of Joshua, we go back and pick up events, and then we come back and see what they were doing afterwards. Well, I think one of the reasons that's helpful is for everyone to remember that this particular tribe had a good start under Joshua. Joshua had specifically conquered these lands, and Judah was given a good start. The south, remember, when they came up and attacked, they came from the south going upward from the north. If there was any part of it that should have been easier, it would have been the south lands rather than the northern lands, because it took so much longer to get out there and the people had time to reinforce themselves. In Joshua 10, you see the assembly of kings that had been slaughtered, that the Amorite kings that Joshua had brought together, and it's that famous passage where they put the foot on the neck, and at those fellows had all been in the cave, and they brung them out, and then they killed them and then hung their bodies. But you can see that that Joshua had decapitated the leadership, if you will, of the Canaanite territory, so that the children of Israel, having conquered the leadership, could go back in and take and execute the rest of God's judgment. Well, the problem is the Canaanites were busy too. After the period of Joshua's death, we don't know exactly how long it is between Joshua dying, the elders, and then the children of Israel gathering themselves together. There was no vacuum. It's not as if the land sat empty and the people just gave up and walked away. They were repopulating areas, taking over new areas, and trying to assemble themselves to fight against the children of Israel. But I think if you can walk away from the first account here, realizing that the detailed chronology of what happens is not the most helpful element to have, but to understand that though much had been accomplished under Joshua, much remained to get done. It would be just as an egregious mistake to read the book of Joshua and say, well, he pretty much killed everybody there in just a few short chapters, and it was done. The land was empty. That's not what happened under Joshua. Joshua did not clear the land. He conquered it. He conquered it in the sense of its headship being brought into submission. But the land was still very much populated with people and kings that needed further work. All right, let's turn to Exodus 23. To this crowd, it should come as no surprise, but it's always better to run brought home's better than three left on base, as they say. And so let's not forget what's happening in Exodus 23. You can see that in this particular section, God is detailing for them what will happen when they come into the land. In 27, I will send my fear before you. I will cause confusion among all the people to whom you come, and will make all your enemies turn their backs to you. And I will send hornets before you, which shall drive out the Hivite, the Canaanite, and the Hittite from before you. And I will not drive them out from before you in 1 year, lest the land become desolate and the beasts of the field become too numerous for you. Little by little I will drive them out from before you until you have increased and you inherit the land. And we'll continue there through 31. And I will set your bounds from the Red Sea to the sea, Philistia, and from the desert to the river. For I will deliver the inhabitants of the land into your hand, and you shall drive them out before you. So here we have God's promise that he was going to deliver these people, but they were not going to walk into a land with welcome banners and largely left desolate. They could take whatever house they wanted. They had to fight. They had to execute the rest of God's judgment. All right. In verse 19, we see that the Lord was with Judah. There was no question that the people had been assisted by God, and it says, but they could not drive out the inhabitants of the lowland because they had chariots of iron. Here we see in this opening account, and I think this picks up the general theme of Judges, the people couldn't do it. The people faltered in their faith. They looked about and they saw those chariots. They had already gone up to the mountains. They had gone to this section and that section. When they got to the lowlands, which is the only place chariots of iron wheels are going to do you any good, they said, can't do it. I'm not going to drive these guys out. We can't fight. Their artillery is just too big for us. Well, this was a fatal mistake on their part. Turn over to Joshua. The point made earlier today about the people being forgetful is very important, because in Joshua chapter 14, and we'll pick it up in verse 13. And Joshua blessed him and gave Hebron to Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, as an inheritance. Hebron, therefore, became the inheritance of Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, and the Kenizzite to this day, because he wholly followed the Lord God of Israel. And the name of Hebron formerly was Kirjath Arba. Arba was the greatest man among the Anakim. Then the land had rest from war. I don't have any idea why I just read that. I got the wrong chapter. I'll read you the verses from an unknown chapter in the Bible. I didn't write it down. I'm sorry. It's not Joshua 14. Okay, well, I'll find that and let you know later what it is. I don't know which chapter it is. Then the children of Joseph spoke to Joshua, saying, "Why have you given us only one lot and one share to inherit, since we are a great people, inasmuch as the Lord has blessed us until now?" These are the two tribes of Joseph. So Joshua answered him, "If you are a great people, then go to the forest country and clear a place for yourself there in the land of the Perizzites and the giants, since the mountains of Ephraim are too confined for you." In verse 16, "But the children of Joseph said, 'The mountain country is not enough for us, and all the Canaanites who dwell in the land of the valley have chariots of iron, both those who are at Beth Shean and the towns, and those who are at the valley of Jezreel.' And Joshua spoke to the house of Joseph, to Ephraim and Manasseh, saying, 'You are a great people and have great power, and you shall not have only one lot, but the mountain country shall be yours. Although it is wooded, you shall cut it down, and its farthest extent shall be yours. For you shall drive out the Canaanites, though they have chariots, iron chariots, and are strong.'"
17.
Oh, thank you very much. I'll make a note of that. Appreciate that. So you see that the presence of these iron chariots was not a recent development in the conquest. Joseph saw this and said, "Wait a minute, we can't do this, the two tribes there." First they said, "We need more land." Said, "Well, by the way, they got tanks over there. It might be easier just to go over here and settle down." Word got back, didn't it? Word travels fast when you want to discourage someone. And so they went right back to the house of Judah. And Judah and Simeon remembered what the house of Joseph had said. Said, "We can't do this." What they forgot was that Joshua was well aware that they had iron chariots in the land. He was also well aware that the word of the Lord was with them. They'd forgotten that part. They had not obeyed the Lord fully by following in all of his commands. All right, when we get to verse 20, we're going back to Caleb's time again. We're not going to touch on that at this point. And when you start in verse 21, you're getting a detailed description of most, but not how all the tribes fared. So it says the Benjamin did not drive out the Jebusites who inhabited Jerusalem. So here's where Jerusalem is at. It was in the territory of Benjamin, and that was given to them that they should drive out that particular set of people. But this one verse gives us some important historical perspective, because it indicates that the book of Judges was most likely written sometime before David. I think disproving the idea that it was a post-exilic book, which some have indicated, that is that way, because if you look at Joshua 15:63 and 2 Samuel 5:6 and 7, you'll see in the Samuel passage, that's when David captures Jerusalem. When David was king, he was king for some time before Jerusalem was actually conquered. And he ended up giving, I don't remember what he gave, for someone to run up and scale the wall and capture Jerusalem and dispossess the Jebusites from that area. But you also see in Joshua 15:63 that the Jebusites remained in the area. So if the writer is saying that Benjamin couldn't drive out the Jebusites and they live here, he must be indicating that this book was written sometime before David had actually taken the land. So we'll put the latest date for the compiling of the book of Judges sometime early in David's reign. Now we move on in verses 22 to 26, and we see the house of Joseph, the same ones who were upset about the chariots of iron that were there, and they have this account where someone has they discover this fella, and they say, "Hey, we'll show you some mercy if you will show us how to capture this city." And we're talking Bethel, right up in here. And I couldn't find a whole lot of differentiation between Bethel and Luz. So what they ended up promising this guy is, if you will help us, we'll let you live. And they let the guy live. They let him go off, his family or whatever. And he starts another city called Luz. Now, it would be a temptation to think that there's a certain parallel given here, as in the account of Ai with Rahab, that you see that their Israelite is sparing someone's life for good reason. Well, this treaty that sons of Joseph made with one of those inhabitants in exchange for the intelligence necessary to conquer the city was a poor exercise of judgment on their part. Rahab had come to faith. Her trust was in the Lord. This guy feared the children of Israel rather than loving the children of Israel. What did he do after he took off? Well, he went and built another city, another monument of idolatry, to persist in his ways and to catechize his children so that they would be able to worship the Canaanite gods of the land. He didn't come to faith. They had no business. They didn't need the intelligence. They didn't need to sell their souls so that they could get a foothold on the land. You see in verses 27 and 28, Manasseh is coming to his turn, and Megiddo is up here, right here. So Manasseh is taking this particular section, and Manasseh didn't want to drive everybody out either. They thought it would be to their advantage to employ them. Why kill all these people? Why? They made good workers. We could hire them. They had a liberal immigration policy. They should have gone out there and conquered the land, and they didn't. Well, now you see Ephraim in verse 29, and they failed over toward Gezer, that they were able, right over here, in their battles. You're still seeing a lot of battles over here, but they were unable to drive out the people in that area. You see Zebulun. They were driving out a place called Kitron and Nahalol. I have no idea where that is. But they failed in their endeavor and also decided to employ everybody. You see Asher in verses 31 and 32. They were up, way up here in Sidon. You have to give them credit for going all the way to the end of their territory. That Sidon was a very important it was functioning capital of the Phoenicians at this time, and it also gives some historical evidence that the book was written earlier on, because Tyre eventually became the Phoenician capital, culturally at least. But they go up here and they attack Sidon, but they weren't able to do everything they needed to do. Then you get Naphtali, and they're up here in Beth Anath, somewhere up in this area. We don't know exactly where that's at. Naphtali is in that. And don't take my lines as this is not part of the inspired Word of God. Neither are the maps in your Bible. But I'm not going to do any better than that. So just keep that in mind. It's roughly. Maybe they were fighting out of bounds. I don't know. But they too found it helpful and more convenient to employ everybody rather than to exterminate them. In fact, I think somewhere the Hebrew indicates that they had a Beth Anath study group to find how they could peacefully coexist with the insurgents in the northern territories. All right, so now you get to the tribe of Dan, and Ajalon is where they're fighting, which is right over here, northwest of Jerusalem. And they had a lot of trouble. We're going to get to Dan in more detail in the coming weeks, but Dan really had a lot of trouble. And it's interesting to see that the scriptures do not describe the fighting of Dan and what they did, but it describes what the Amorites did to Dan. In effect, they whipped him. The Amorites forced the children of Dan into the mountains. It was a cut and run for them. They decided not to even bother to fight for whatever reason. It's also worth mentioning, and I think that contributes to verse 36. Now, the boundary of the Amorites was from the ascent of Akrabbim from Sela and upward. So you see more of a description given to the people who were there in the land rather than to the children of Israel, which tells you something's terribly, terribly gone south. It's helpful to know that Issachar and Reuben are not mentioned in this chronology of what happened. And that's one of the points I think it's helpful to remember. Not everything in every tribe in every date was going wrong. When you read the book of Joshua, you can often walk away and think, wow, Joshua, they just conquered everything. It was a done deal. Move the book of Judges, they didn't do anything right. And I think both those readings are wrong. Joshua certainly served the Lord with his whole heart all his days. It is said of Caleb, when we mistakenly read in Joshua 14, he had served the Lord with his whole heart. They did what they were supposed to do. They conquered what they had set out to conquer. But their task was not to completely exterminate the land during their lifetime. God said, you're not going to be able to do it. You need to grow and grow and move into those areas and take over. The book of Judges showed us that it didn't take long for they forgot the promises of God and began to walk in fearfulness. In this chapter, we find two instances of the phrase that the Lord was with them. Well, what exactly might that mean to say that the Lord is with you? Well, the captain of the army of the Lord's army, was Jesus Christ. When Joshua crossed the Jordan, you recall, he walks up and sees somebody over there and he says, "Whose side are you on?" He said, "I'm sorry, but you've got the wrong perspective here. You serve me. Take your shoes off and worship." And Joshua did, because he met Christ. The word of the Lord was promised that these people would go in and take the land. And, just as importantly, that they would execute God's judgment. And they failed. They utterly failed to heed the word of Christ. They did not do as they were commanded to do. This disobedience was going to cost Israel in dear ways. They were content to allow the Canaanites to live and to worship as they saw fit. No indication is given in this opening account that when they decided to put people into tribute, that they removed their foreign gods from them. At least you might be able to give them a point or two for that. But they decided to peacefully coexist and say, religious tolerance is what's needed here. Compromise, indifference to the honor of God, which idolatry insults, indolence, love of gain, made Israel content with imposing tribute, even when they were strong enough to extirpate them. You see, it was love of money and the things of this world that they set their eyes on when they went in the land of Canaan. They said, "This is good land, let's take it." Well, let's not take that part. Why don't we put them under tribute? We'll bother them. We'll just tax them to death. They were content because they saw riches coming to them. Put them under tribute. Make them carry the water and the stone and do the hard job. It'd be a lot easier for us, when God had never given them permission to do that. Let's turn back to Exodus 23. I didn't read that entire account, but I do want to finish it. Exodus 23, we read up through verse 31, where God told them that He would not drive out the land, drive out the inhabitants of the land all at once. And we'll continue with how he closes this in verse 32. "You shall make no covenant with them, nor with their gods. They shall not dwell in your land, lest they make you sin against me. For if you serve their gods, it will surely be a snare to you." God's warning to the children of Israel was that they would not be able to withstand the temptation of idolatry. They would not be able to withstand the lure of the Canaanite gods and the Canaanite ways. And they didn't. They failed. The same thing that kept their fathers 40 years out of Canaan kept them now out of the full possession of it. And that was unbelief. They refused to believe God's word. distrust of the power and the promise of God lost them all their advantages and ran them into 1,000 mischiefs. Serious business obeying God. We have the Word of God given to these people, and the book of Judges is here to tell us what they did right, what they did wrong, and what were the consequences of those decisions. Judah did a good thing by saying, let's serve the Lord. They called on the name of the Lord and said, what shall we do? But they didn't follow through. They didn't wholly obey. And half-hearted obedience is utter disobedience. And when you fool around with idolatry, you're going to be ensnared. This is the lesson of the opening of Judges 1. That pays to follow the Lord with your whole heart. We'll have just a minute or so for questions, and we're going to have to close it. It's kind of an abrupt close, but it's the way it is.